My guest today is Anna Wong, Chief U.S. Economist at Bloomberg Economics. Previously, she was a principal economist at the Federal Reserve. In 2019 and 2020, she was seconded to the White House Council of Economic Advisors. Prior to the Fed, she worked at the U.S. Treasury Department and the Peterson Institute. I can imagine few people in the world better suited to analyze and forecast the impact of the Trump tariffs on the economy. Before we get started, I want to remind you that this podcast is not investment advice. It is intended for informational and entertainment purposes only.
Anna Wong, welcome to Onward.
Happy to be here, Ben.
I'm super excited because everything that's happening in the world, I feel like you're the perfect person to be talking to. But before we get started, I want to just give a little bit of your background so people understand how much of a rock star you are. So do you want to just tell us a thumbnail of your career?
So I started off spending my formative years at the Peterson Institute for International Economics. In early 2000s, at the times of global imbalances, the debate in Washington, D.C. at that time was that trade deficit of the U.S. was widening to an unsustainable pace and that the surplus countries of China and Europe are building up their reserves and IMF and Treasury got to do something to stop this from continuing to happen. And that was also the period where Bernanke talked about the global saving gluts, and subsequently many academic literature had traced some of the roots of the global financial crisis in 2008 to those huge capital inflows going into the U.S. economy in the early 2000s. Then I did my PhD at University of Chicago, and I worked at U.S. Treasury for 4 years, covering the U.S. external accounts. And I worked for another 5 years at the Federal Reserve, covering the Chinese economy for the Fed. And of one of those 5 years, I was seconded to the Council of Economic Advisors at the White House, and that was from 2019 to 2020. So I was there in the tail end of the first trade war, and the work I did in the first half of my year at CEA was thinking about the effect of the tariffs from 2018 to 2019. And also, I would say at CEA, we had played a key role in Trump taking the phase one deal with China, de-escalating the trade war. And then the pandemic hits, and I spent the rest of my time at CEA focusing on forecasting the collapse of the U.S. GDP at an unprecedented time, and also thinking through about how much stimulus is needed and how the stimulus is feeding through U.S. balance sheets and consumers and all that. And then I've been at Bloomberg for almost 4 years now, covering purely the domestic economy.
Okay, wow. So you were in the White House Situation Room when the first meeting on the coronavirus happened. So what was that like? Or did people appreciate how big it was going to be?
No. So that first meeting happened in January. And the reason why I was in the room, because I was dealing with the trade war. I was supposed to be a macro person, a person focused on China. The coronavirus was first thought to be a China problem. And it was supposed to be, at least from what I thought, and I was, of course, grossly mistaken. That was one of my largest forecast error in my whole career. I wrote a memo about the impact on U.S. economy. That was in early January, purely on spillovers from China. We're thinking that this weird disease will be just like SARS in 2003, which shaved off China's growth by only 2 to 4 percentage point at most and generating a 1 percentage point spillover on U.S. economy. And then at that time, the government was only really counting the number of cases one by one that's happening in the U.S. And the things that was discussed as travel ban, all these countries are, should we impose travel bans? And Peter Navarro was very early. And this I have to give credit to Peter Navarro, who a lot of people, including a lot of economists in the White House then, see him as this nefarious figure. I would even say maybe a nickname would be Peter Navarez. However, he was very early in saying that this virus could potentially be a really big thing. And he wrote memos very early on that there should be travel ban and that there should be export control in the U.S. on these key ingredients that could factor into producing a vaccine. And that was a formative time for my maturity as an economist, right? Because I spent most of my professional life amongst mainstream economists. And to see that Navarro's view on what things should be done when he wrote it in January, February, March of 2020, because the nationwide shutdown only happened in March. It was then that it became really obvious what's going on. But he was writing back in January. Another person who was really ahead of the curve is Matt Pottinger, who was the Deputy National Security Council advisor at the time. So it's a shock that in April, New York Times wrote a piece basically saying that Peter Navarro was right and that spinning Peter Navarro as the person who was so correct in sounding the early alarm of the pandemic and things like that. So to see a person who embodies the unconventional way of economic thinking and the person who's like the bad guy and New York Times acknowledge he is right, that makes me think a lot. And on hindsight, I also thought about the policies that we pushed for in those first couple of months, travel bans. The traditional economic literature would say travel bans have no use, no point, and that the only ways that travel bans could ever work is if it's imposed in a remote island like New Zealand. But on hindsight, I would think that had the travel ban on Europe happened earlier than it actually happened, because the policies were actually discussed on imposing a travel ban on Europe earlier. Had it been earlier, then New York would probably not be as hard hit. There's time to prepare, because I think what I read is that the COVID strain in New York came from Europe. So I just think that the lesson from that period of my life is that sometimes unconventional policies work in crazy times. And in crazy times like that, you have to be very open-minded and be very practical, most of all, and not hang on to your models too religiously.
Well, that's a great way to tee up the current conversation. And again, Peter Navarro is in the headlines. I think he's instrumental in some of these trade policies today.
Yes, very much so.
So today's April 4th. Liberation Day was 48 hours ago. I'm going to try to set the stage. U.S. has raised tariffs across, I think it's higher than they've been 100 years approximately. And China just retaliated with matching our U.S. tariffs, 34%. And then I think Vietnam talking about dropping their tariffs. So that's where the state of the game is today. As we game plan the future, people have to understand. They'll probably listen to this podcast Monday, and I'm sure there'll be a lot more information we'll have at that point. So I would like to do something we call scenario planning, which is a structured way of trying to think about the future. The typical way that we do it is you do a scenario that's a good scenario, which is usually a linear extrapolation of the present to the future. In this case, that would be the bad scenario. So a good scenario, a bad scenario, and then a surprise scenario. Those would be the three scenarios I'd love for you to walk me through. So if you start with a good scenario, which is where the Trump administration's plans succeed, I would love for you to sketch out the short-term success and then a long-term success, and then just flip that around and do the opposite. Okay, catastrophe. What does a really bad scenario look like? And then the third will be something new, something different. If you wanted to do your baseline scenario, that'd be fine too.
I think the surprise scenario would be very fun.
Yeah, surprise scenario. I thought about this more than you probably. So I have some ones I could throw at you that I think would be fun. Maybe not so fun, but interesting surprises.
I have some really fun ones too. Crazy ones.
Oh, good. Oh, then I'm really excited for that. So let's do the good thing, because I think everybody's pretty negative at the moment in the press. So let's just start with, what does success look like? Maybe success in your view and the Trump administration's view. How does this play out well?
I think this good scenario would be basically how the Trump administration is thinking about it. So it's basically explaining Trump's perspective, this good scenario. So in this good scenario, Trump perceived that the state of the world that he's been living in the past 20 years is a suboptimal equilibrium in a prisoner's dilemma, where the U.S. is engaged with the rest of the world in a free trade mode, whereas the rest of the world is not in a free trade mode with the U.S. He thinks that U.S. has been suckered into free trade and it's decimated our industrial towns, our manufacturing capacity. So these tariffs, what he wanted to do is that it would increase the domestic manufacturing capacity, increase the steel capacity. And also, I think for him, his formative experience in the first White House is that both the trade war and COVID taught him that supply chain resiliency in the U.S. is a number one national security priority. So with these tariffs, he thinks, well, on one hand, now with the tariffs at 22% on track to be 28% after you add on the pharmaceutical and things that he's going to add in the next few weeks, it could raise about $790 billion to even $900 billion in tariffs, assuming that they stay in place for the whole year. So to him, he's like, you got more revenues, and at the same time, you could encourage more domestic production. But the best thing for him is if he gets other foreign countries to invest domestically in the U.S., to invest in the domestic manufacturing capability of the U.S. A prime example would be the other day, TSMC announced that they're going to be doing a joint venture with Intel. And to him, that is the outcome he wants to see. He wants to see this type of joint venture or whatever the term you call this to be in all the sector. And also, why does he want to secure Greenland? Why does he want to secure this country, which is sparsely populated? It's because he wants to secure rare minerals. And you just mentioned that China retaliated by raising their tariff on U.S. exports. But U.S. mainly exports soybeans to China to feed the pigs. Chinese consumers love pork, and U.S. soybeans is what goes toward feeding those pigs. But the size of U.S. exports to China is so small. It's only about $160 billion. The more effective retaliation that China has been practicing are export controls. And already we are seeing in these U.S. ISM manufacturing surveys that people are complaining about the germanium mineral that they were unable to access. And that's because China has access to a lot of rare minerals in the world, and these rare minerals go to our production with semiconductors. So the race to be the winner of AI will be the global leader in the future. So from Trump's perspective, expanding the U.S. territory to include Greenland, tariffs are all going towards the goal of securing supply chain resiliency. And the second part of his optimistic view of his policy is fiscal. So as a byproduct of these, as we have seen this week, the Treasury yields have plunged. 10-year yields are at a 3-handle. And we have seen that both Scott Bessent, the Treasury Secretary, and Trump himself has made 10-year yields as one of the metric of success. They want the 10-year yield to fall. And this year, just so far, we have already seen 10-year yields fall by close to, I think, 80 bips from when he was elected. And the fiscal debt of the U.S. is on an unsustainable path. And what makes it particularly scary is that there's, I believe, $7 to $9 trillion that are set to be refinanced in the third quarter of this year from a previously very low interest rate, I believe 2-ish, because they were issued during the QE, during the 2020, 2021, when interest rates were really low. Had the U.S. Treasury not declined, then they'll be rolling over to 4.5, 4.2 from 2-point-ish. This is why the interest rate payments on U.S. debt is on track to exceed how much we spent on defense in 2027. That's why 2027 is a key date. That's why you hear people like Ray Dalio who said that a sovereign crisis is awaiting U.S. in 3 years' time. Because that's when the net interest payment is about to explode because of these ongoing refinancing. These debts are rolling over from low interest rate to high interest rate. So from the Trump administration point of view, getting the 10-year yield rates to come down immediately is actually quite urgent because you have this $9 trillion rolling over. So if the 10-year yields can go down to 3%, and from their perspective, they are hoping that it will be a mild recession. I'm not saying they hope for a recession. Nobody hopes for a recession. But if their worst case scenario is a mild recession, but the cost of that mild recession is the benefit of the 10-year yields falling to 3.0, and that immediately lower the trajectory of the net interest payments in the next couple of years, I think that is a cost they are prepared to pay. And to them, that would be a good scenario. The ideal scenario is that there's no recession and that growth would just slow to between 0 and 1%, stay there, unemployment rate hover at max 4.6%, and 10-year yields go down to 3.0, and inflation just goes to 2.4%. To them, that would be a great scenario because on top of that, then they can use those tariff revenues, as I mentioned, that's 600 to 900 billion of tariff revenues, to pay for the extension of their tax cut, which probably the full extension of the tax cut, which will be in the reconciliation bill, which will likely be passed during the summer. So for them, all of this could make sense because the pain is front-loaded in the first 3 months of the administration. Then after the tax bill comes, then the sentiment will improve because there will be full extension of the tax cut. On top of that, some other additional quirks on tax cuts. So by the time next November 2026 comes along, the economy would be on the full swing upwards. That's probably the best case scenario.
Okay, but let me just try to flesh that out a little bit more so that I can try to get my mind around believing it. Because I feel like if I can believe it, then I can imagine it and I can prepare for it.
You don't need to believe it. It's a good case scenario.
But the best way to prepare for something is really imagine it happening and then think about what you'd be doing in that situation. So, okay, don't they need a deal with China? Is the best case scenario is the tariffs stay in place or they negotiate?
Oh yeah, I forgot to mention this part. Yes, part of the best case scenario is that many of these tariffs will be negotiated down over the next 3 to 6 months, but not the Chinese one, likely. I don't think the Chinese one will be negotiated down, but the other ones would be. So while currently the effective tariff is 22%, on track to be 28% in a couple of weeks, after the negotiation, which will lead to more investment from foreign firms in U.S. manufacturing capability. So that's implied in my statement that there will be increased foreign participation in U.S. manufacturing in exchange for lower tariffs. So once that happens, I think that the U.S. effective tariff rate would settle between 10 to 15% permanently.
So can you, again, trying to flesh to this scenario, what would be some companies that you can imagine, new ones? So I've seen some announcements, but what are some examples of companies and countries that would do what you're describing?
For example, you have already seen Taiwan offer the TSMC. Vietnam already offered to lower their tariffs. And I think particularly countries which are traditionally U.S. allies in Asia particularly, like South Korea, India, and Malaysia, U.S. would probably be more friendly and conducive to offering to lower the tariff in exchange for some concessions on investment. So, for example, Malaysia exports a lot of active medical ingredients to U.S. pharmaceutical commodities. I'm not an equity person, so I cannot really tell you about company names. I would just say that at the sectoral and trade level, I think some of these countries which are not really U.S. targets and are not too large in terms of their impact on U.S. trade deficit would likely see a lower tariff going forward. The ones where U.S. have structural trade barriers from the U.S. perspective are places like China, Germany, and particularly EU sounds really feisty. The national rhetoric coming from EU in response to U.S.-induced trade war appear to be really feisty. At least many of the Asian countries are willing to stay silent, but it's possible that the trade war with the Europeans will drag on a lot longer.
So what does success look like with China?
I fear that there won't be an outcome that is successful. It may look successful on the surface, but ultimately there is a rivalry to be the global leader. It's a clash of civilization. I'm hard-pressed to find an optimistic scenario with China. Maybe success would be lowering the tariffs, because right now the tariffs with China is at least 67%, possibly going higher. Success may be lowering to 45%. But with tariffs on Chinese goods at 45%, that still means that U.S. imports from China could decrease by 70 to 80% over the long term, basically eviscerating U.S.-China trade.
I heard that there's some scenarios where U.S.-China trade goes close to zero. And I'm trying to imagine how companies like Apple or a lot of companies manufacture components in China. What's that transition look like in a successful scenario?
I suppose that from the Trump administration's perspective, a successful case for Apple is if they announce investment in creating factories in the U.S.
So then the Apple phone costs $3,000 a phone. Is that what success looks like?
Well, I think the Trump's horizon is longer than 1 year. And the moving production across border will take many years. And it could be many, many years later. Then don't forget that scarcity is oftentimes the mother of innovation. And if there are not enough people to produce it, and there's too many unions, then automate. Who knows 4 to 8 years from now how robots or the manufacturing process will look like.
Okay. Are there any countries that you think will make a deal with the United States that ends up being the model of success? I'm still trying to stay on the success scenario.
The model of, and Ben, let me just be clear that this is the most optimistic scenario. We're both trying to imagine it. I'm not selling it. I'm explaining. You're asking me to imagine it. I'm imagining it for you. And if it's hard to imagine, it's okay.
I have this thing I learned from a friend called Most Generous Interpretation, MGI. So I usually try to use that first before I get to the negative side. So I'm trying to do that here. What about India? So India is probably the swing global or geopolitical country in the world. And maybe you could see a lot of Apple factories moving to India. Is that success in the Trump administration?
Possible if India offers something else to Trump.
Their view, they really want to bring this manufacturing back to the United States.
There are probably two factions within the Trump administration. One are those hardcore who want to bring it back to the United States. The second group is more like, it's okay if it's nearshoring, not onshoring. So basically the terminology is nearshoring or onshoring. And many Republicans are already formerly free traders. And to them, tariffs are distasteful, not to mention onshoring. So I think a large proportion of Republicans would be pushing an okay with nearshoring.
Is that Mexico or who else is that?
Yeah, nearshoring to France.
To France, okay.
I think the reason why Mexico was a target in this current Trump administration not only was because of immigration issues, but also because Mexico was perceived as a backdoor for China exports. This is why if Mexico voluntarily imposed a 50% tariff on China, I think Trump would be more amenable to reducing the tariff between U.S. and Mexico.
Isn't that the same challenge with Vietnam and other countries?
Exactly. So I think a situation where Trump would be okay is if these countries who are perceived as the backdoor for Chinese transshipments voluntarily erect trade barriers vis-a-vis China, for Trump, he would think that, well, then I will be more open with free trade with you. But I think he's playing a whack-a-mole game. We're just really drawn to the bad scenario right now. We're stretching our imagination. Let's move on.
Fine. So let's do the bad scenario, and maybe there's scenarios here, plural. So walk me through how this goes badly. It'd be great if you could do it chronologically, like here we are today. How would it play out over the next few months where it really goes poorly for us?
Yeah, I think the bad scenario would be what the models are expecting. So economic models would say that the tariffs at the current level, which is supposed to be going higher, would knock, I believe, about 3% off GDP. That would be recession. And on top of that, the models would suggest that inflation would be about 2% higher. So that would make this into stagflation. So when you have inflation at, say, 4% at the end of this year or next year, the Fed will be hiking rates. Even if the unemployment rate were to be at 4.5 or even 5%, remember at the peak of inflation in 2022, I believe core PCE peaks at 5.4%. So now if you look at these sell-side shops who are revising their inflation outlook, you have places, some of them are saying 5%. Citadel, UBS, they have 5% core PCE inflation in their outlook. If that's the case, they're basically saying there will be a return to 2022 type of monetary policy. And worst of all, it will be stagflationary because the labor market will be weakening too. And the absolute worst case scenario is if inflation expectations, or at least if the Fed interprets the inflation expectations to be unanchored. So it doesn't matter. I think the absolute worst scenario is if inflation expectations actually didn't unanchor, but the Fed thinks it did, then that policy mistake would be that the Fed would be raising rates when they should not be raising rates. And that would totally exacerbate the downturn and the economy would be in a deep recession.
Yeah, but wouldn't it be even worse if you have higher rates and the 3% GDP shock? Aren't you talking about negative, even more than that, negative 5% on GDP?
That's a stagflationary shock. A stagflationary shock has to be that the GDP has to be zero or even negative while inflation was really, really high.
So where's unemployment in that situation?
Unemployment would go to 6 in that case. If the Fed were to be raising rates, even as unemployment were to be moving upward, I would say once unemployment started breaching 4.5, 4.6, and the Fed did nothing, that would really trigger these nonlinear dynamics, and you can't control it once you unleash the Kraken. There could even be something worse. What's even worse is that the Fed is not offering the Fed put. They're not cutting rates. Worse, they're hiking rates. And on top of that, Trump also decided not to pivot, stick with his tariffs. So you have neither the Trump put or the Fed put. That would be an ingredient for a deep recession. On top of the actual economics of it, which is that when you have higher trade barriers, then it leads to perhaps manufacturing inefficiency and cost of production is higher. It slows down the potential GDP growth of U.S. over the next 4 to 8 years. And looking internationally, if in this period where U.S. is in stagflation, if China continue to make progress on AI, and also if Germany and China and the rest of the world were able to successfully bend together and create their own isolated economic region, excluding U.S., that would be pretty bad. Because since World War II, the explicit or implicit international monetary system, basically it is configured as U.S. generates the demand for all the other countries' goods. And all the other countries in the rest of the world basically sell to the U.S. This relationship has persisted for 70 years, 80 years. And suddenly, if U.S. were to do a self-imposed exile and all the other countries were able to also be self-sufficient among themselves and prosper, which I actually don't think is the likely scenario, honestly, just as our optimistic scenario could be too optimistic, even in this scenario, it's too pessimistic because I do think that much of these relationship is very much entrenched because imagine how could South Korea, Japan, and China band together for a trade region when they all just wanted to sell to the U.S. For example, China's goods have been produced for selling to the U.S. market. The fashion from Shein or Temu does not fit the needs of South Koreans. South Koreans have their own fashion. Japanese have their own fashion. It will be very difficult for China to sell goods they intended for the U.S. market to other Asian markets.
Also, don't they have their own geopolitical conflict?
Yes, absolutely. Historical relationships and geopolitical conflicts. But I'm just saying, this is a bad scenario. So bad. Actually, it could get worse, but I'm just keeping the really, really worse for our third surprise scenario.
Well, let me just ask some follow-up questions here. So, what's the policy rationale for the Fed to raise rates when rates primarily impact demand and this is supply shock? Is that the right way to think about this? That by increasing the costs of supplies, already you're going to have a decrease in consumer spending. Why raise rates? How does that help lower inflation really in practice?
So in a traditional Fed model, that's exactly how things work. When a supply shock hits, then prices temporarily became elevated, and that lowers consumption, and thereby natural economic forces would force disinflation over time. So that's why the Fed should not move. That is exactly the argument why the Fed should not be raising rates or responding to a transitory supply shock. But the arguments for responding to it by either not cutting or even raising rates is if they think that inflation expectations are not anchored. And then in that case, even the model that the Fed have would say they should be responding. Because if inflation expectations are not anchored, then we will see what we saw in 1970s here, which is that there will be a wage price spiral. As prices increase, Then everybody would start bid up each other's prices. All the firms started raising prices. Then there's this wage price spiral will reinforce each other. And over time, the natural mechanism for disinflation to take hold would break down. And you just see higher and higher and higher inflation over a period of 5 to 10 years. And the tricky thing about this is that inflation expectations are very hard to monitor. The Fed does have a range of indicators they look at. There's a whole bunch of market indicators they look at based on Wall Street pricing of inflation swaps or inflation compensation 5 years from now. But then there's also survey-based inflation expectations like the University of Michigan or the New York Fed Survey of Consumer Expectations. But really, the Fed is taking a wild guess based on these results. By the time that inflation expectations are truly unanchored, it'll be too late already. So the Fed always wants to preempt this from happening. And if they were to be worried about the expectations are unanchoring, they will be taking decisive measures, just as they did in June 2022. Back in June 2022, when the Fed raised rates by 75 basis points, sure, the inflation print is high. But they were actually more worried by the 5 to 10 year inflation expectations reading in the University of Michigan survey.
I'm trying to imagine how rates expectations move much higher in a recession. Because the 1970s was a different period. There was real supply constraints. It wasn't just about price. You literally couldn't get oil at some places. You couldn't get gas. It wasn't available at prices that were possible. There was a lot of policy mistakes in that era. So can you tell me what things would be happening on the ground? Imagine storytelling. The things you would say, oh, if this happened, that's the thing that would actually change rate expectations.
So in this bad scenario, recall, Ben, I said that it's not that inflation expectations are actually unanchored, but it's just that the Fed thinks it's unanchored, but it's not actually unanchored. Because then by raising rates, it would be a policy mistake. But what you're asking me just now is basically moving to the third scenario of what I was prepared to say. And the third scenario truly is maybe one of the worst of the worst of the worst, which is which is that this trade war caused China to take aggressive action toward Taiwan, and that U.S. also take aggressive action toward Iran. So what you have would have a double whammy of supply shock. Well, if you invade Iran or attack Iran, then oil price would surge. But the new oil in today's era that's comparable to oil in 1970s is really semiconductors, which is where Taiwan comes in. So if you do have war, then truly that is stagflation, because that would be comparable to the second oil shock in late 1970s. If I were to compare today to that period, it's most similar to today we're at the cusp of 1969 and 1971. The tariffs is like Nixon shock. Nixon imposed the 10% unilateral tariffs to bring all these countries on the table to get them to appreciate their exchange rate against the U.S. And as a result, that ended the Bretton Woods system, the convertibility of U.S. to gold. And I think today's macro situation puts us at around that time. So Powell may not be Arthur Burns. It could be the next Fed chairman that will arrive next spring, 2026, who would be the Arthur Burns if this third scenario happens. But certainly the Fed chairman in the 1960s, though he did not go down history with a reputation as bad as Arthur Burns, also is responsible to the wage price spiral in the 1970s, implicitly. What he did is that he didn't bring inflation back to target when he could have. And while Chairman Powell may eventually blame Trump for inflation not returning to target, I think the truth of the matter is inflation was not going back to target even without Trump. And that was the key insight in Arthur Burns' very notorious speech in 1970s, where history judged that speech very harshly. They said that he just didn't have the political courage to raise interest rate. But I think that in that speech, one of the key insights, what he said is that shocks constantly come, supply shocks, whatever shocks, arrived in an unpredictable manner. If the central bank could not bring inflation back to target on a timely manner, then these shocks are going to hit at whatever time. And then the Fed would be drifting away and away from the target. It's like, do you sail, Ben?
A little, not really.
If you're a sailor or you drive a boat, if you have a man overboard, you really got to point to that man. A finger, a person has to be physically pointing to that man and immediately pick him up. Otherwise, the boat drifts away. So if you're really close to that man and you couldn't pick that man up, and you delay it, you just drift further and further and further. That's basically Arthur Burns' insight that you got to do it on a timely manner. And if not, new shocks will hit. And in a timely manner means you got to keep real interest rate above 2%. It's sufficiently restrictive. And what we have seen the Fed did in the past 5 years is that the inflation target has been above 2% for already almost 5 years. And in the last 5 years, the Fed tried to precisely calibrate rates such that there is no recession and because they have a dual mandate. But at the same time, inflation is not exactly on target. And now they are celebrating amongst themselves that they have successfully generated a soft landing. The fact is, they also unsuccessfully returned inflation to target in 5 years. So here, with Trump's tariffs on Liberation Day, here comes another shock. And it's like that analogy where I just gave you that if you have a man overboard, if you don't pick him up ASAP, it's just going to drift away. And that's also repeating the insight of Arthur Burns.
So you're saying that the Fed, if they really were worried about this shock, they would raise rates fast right away or be much more hawkish in the short term so that it doesn't get away from them if they wait too long.
Yes, but I think that the mistakes are paved over a period in the 60s and 70s, the wage price spiral, because we are on the point of this wage price spiral, stagflation. The wage price spiral in the 70s is not just blamed on the Iranian shock. That's not the sole factor, possibly not even the dominant factor. I think the dominant factor is the end of Bretton Woods, the end of the gold to dollar convertibility. And how is it applicable to today? So if Trump's tariff lead to a loss of the dollar as a reserve currency, the loss of dollar reserve currency status, which is a byproduct of the Bretton Woods 1 or 2 arrangement. In the first arrangement, it was explicit, the link between gold and dollar. In the second Bretton Woods, it was implicit that everybody treat the dollar backed by the U.S. sovereign as the trust of the U.S. But if these tariffs cause the loss of this dollar reserve status, that means there's permanently less foreign demand for dollar, permanently less foreign demand for U.S. Treasury. That could lead to more expensive fiscal financing over time. The lower dollar also could lead to more inflationary pressure over time. So all these are very stagflationary, very similar to the post-Nixon shock, 1971. And Nixon knows that the 10% tariffs could potentially be inflationary. That's why at the same time as that Nixon shock 10% tariff announcement, he also announced the wage and price freeze. And for a while, for at least a year, the wage and price freeze worked. But then the moment they removed it and then the oil shock hits, then you see this wage price spiral. History rarely repeats itself similarly, but there are just a lot of rhymes. Certainly, I agree with Powell that we are not in the late 1970s yet, but we are very close. We have been living through the similarity of late 1960s, setting the stage for whatever to come. So these exogenous shocks that may come in the next couple of years could determine whether we are in 1973, 74 or not.
I had a couple of surprises I wanted to throw at you. Mine were related to the fiscal side. So you have austerity or budget cuts likely to come through Congress and the Trump administration. You didn't really mention that. And I know you've talked a lot about how the Biden administration had a lot of stealth stimulus, which the Trump administration has been removing. So with those cuts of various kinds happening to the federal spending, isn't that one more stick on the fire?
So my baseline is that the tariffs would be the supply inflation impact of tariffs would be constrained by the decrease in economic activity from the removal of those stealth stimulus. I think that the slowdown in consumption is not just due to tariffs. It's due to other things like 10 million people are about to see their credit score decrease by 50 to 180 points. And that will have long-lasting impact on their consumption behavior. Imagine if somebody discovered that their credit score, they are, used to be prime and they are now subprime, then it affects their ability to buy a house. It affects their ability to buy a car, not to mention the cars also are experiencing massive tariffs. So I think that economic growth was going to slow anyway, and the tariff, they accelerate these shocks, because what the tariff is, primarily the burden has fallen on the stock market, because if firms cannot pass through the input price increase, then they take a margin hit. Margin hit means stock market. And stock market, most of the stock market is held by the top 10 to 20% of wealth in a country. So in that sense, tariff is indirectly a progressive tax because it affects the wealth holder. So I think that my baseline for the economy was things were going to slow anyway, but now the stock market is further hit because of the tariffs, and unemployment rate is going to go up because of the margin compression. And I think the unemployment rate would hit 4.8% by the end of this year, possibly maxing out at 5-ish around spring of 2026. And then when a new Fed chairman comes in spring of 2026, and also that coincided with the period where inflation should be slowing and coming down, because that's just basically how inflation reacts to a labor market deterioration, then there will be a lot more aggressive Fed rate cuts in 2026. I'm expecting now only one rate cut this year, but 100 basis point of rate cuts next year.
That's your baseline. And what has happened with the tariffs in that baseline scenario? Is it they have stayed on more or less?
My baseline is that the tariffs would peak at 29%, but then post-negotiation would settle at about 15%. So that would generate about around $300 billion in revenues per year.
And then where is PCE again, or CPI?
So core PCE, I think, will return close to target by the end of next year.
So your baseline is like a pretty good scenario, I feel.
Is it good for unemployment rate to reach 5 point something and the stock market to have fallen by 30%?
Well, I guess after the bad scenario where it went to 6%, I don't know where the stock market is in the scenario you described. So what would make you change your priors? What would make you change your baseline to be either better or worse?
The first thing I think would be very influential is if the Fed truly is willing to cut this year. So far, what we have seen is that Powell has sounded remarkably dovish. In the last FOMC press conference from the March meeting, he even mentioned how inflation from tariffs could be transitory. While I believe it's transitory, I doubt he truly believes it's transitory, because I think that the majority of the FOMC members, as well as the Fed's Federal Reserve Board staff, they're probably penciling in core PCE to be hitting over 3.0 at the end of this year. But I think Powell has been downplaying it lately just because he wanted to avoid a political fire from the White House. So suppose that he truly believed in the transitory view of tariff inflation against the recommendations of his staff and the rest of the FOMC. Suppose he truly believes it, and he's willing to use his soft power as a chairman to impose his views on the majority against the wish of the majority of the FOMC, like what he did last September when he cut rates by 50 bips. Most of the FOMC didn't want it, but he was the one who said, let's cut. So if he applies that authority on the rest of the committee and the Fed staff, then I think we actually do have a hope of truly achieving a soft landing, because the tariffs will clean out the last mile of getting inflation back to target by the end of next year, because the tariff imposed some hardship, generated a very mild recession that the Fed should have generated in order to bring inflation in target effectively. But basically, Trump finished the last mile on inflation, and the Powell cut on time, then I think that would truly be the best outcome. But I doubt that will happen.
You've said to me in the past about some fears you have of institutional and other bias at the Fed. Do you want to expand on that here?
I think it's well known that if you look at the voters' registration of Fed staff, over 90% are registered as Democrats. And the ratio that was published in this independent research was 48-2 in terms of Democrats to Republicans. And you know, economics, as much as it claims to be a scientific field, is full of judgment, which is indirectly related to one political ideology. And just to give you some example of how judgment factor into one's forecast, for example, one could be, what fiscal multiplier should I put on a tax cut? So more left-leading institutions might say that the multiplier from a tax cut on economic activity would be really low, whereas they would also assume that the tax multiplier on raising tax rates on the wealthy would be also very small. So a lot of actually going back to 2020 and 2021 on the issue of these fiscal stimulus checks, how would it stimulate the economy? Then some of the judgment among economists is that, well, it would not directly translate to spending. The multiplier on economic activity would be lower, but in fact, it was very big because the stimulus checks really jacked up the demand for a lot of goods. So I do worry that groupthink would affect the way that the Fed would respond to the current economic situation, but it sounds like Powell is truly trying to strike a political stance and trying to play both sides, and it's hard to tell whether Powell truly believes in the neutrality that he is striking, or is he saying it just to protect the independence of the Fed and try to avoid the political fire from the Trump administration?
In your baseline scenario for China, tariffs come down some, there's a mild recession or maybe almost even soft landing, PCE normalizes 18 months from now. What's happening in China during that time? How much is their trade falling with the US? What's happening to their economy? What's happening politically? You understand China more than most people. So can you tell me how you think this plays out in China the rest of the next few years?
I think my baseline for the U.S. tariffs on China is that it ultimately settles between 30-45%. But that would still imply that the U.S. trade imports from China would decrease by 60% or 70% over time. So that means that China will have to find alternative sources of demand. And in the last 4 years, one of China's growth challenges is to generate enough domestic demand. Consumption demand has been at rock bottom, partly due to the housing market. China's housing market has a big overhang and will require several years to clear the excess housing inventory. And many of the Chinese households have put their wealth on betting on the housing market, which is why the bust in the housing market is playing such a big role in decreasing the wealth and hence their consumer confidence. And China also has been refraining from the all-out fiscal infrastructure stimulus that they did in 2009 and 2016 because they also have a local-level debt problem. U.S. has a federal-level debt problem. China has a local-level debt problem. So now, if the U.S. tariffs will maintain at an elevated level like that vis-a-vis China, China will have to either find the replacement for the U.S. demand from the other countries like Europe or other Asian countries, or they have to replace it with domestic demand either coming from private consumption or a government stimulus. And I think to stabilize the Chinese government likely will expand fiscal stimulus. They will provide measures to stimulate the stock market, shore up the stock market, generate wealth effect for Chinese households. Worst comes to worst. Kind of like what Hitler did post-World War I, which is usually in history, we have seen examples where when the economic circumstances is really dire and you can blame that circumstances on external factors, you could increase nationalism. And this is why our third scenario of an invasion on Taiwan is a situation if U.S. push too hard and put China in a corner, and they have to do something, that is really the ultimate retaliation.
How do you look at those probabilities? You have 50-50, 10% chance?
I would not even dare to put a probability on this, Ben, okay, because that would be World War III. Imagine if U.S. invade Iran and then China attacks Taiwan, then you will have a two-front war, one in Middle East, one in Asia. it will be World War III, and we won't even care about economics anymore because nobody would care about economics at that time.
There's $30 trillion of foreign investment in the United States today. I think it's something like $8.5 trillion treasuries, $15 trillion equities, trillions of bonds. Foreign investors, how do you think they react to this? Are you going to see them pulling dollars out of the U.S.? Because that would drive the currency down a lot.
That's what one would expect if the dollar lose its reserve currency status and the exorbitant privilege. It will be more costly to finance the fiscal debt. So in a way that all this would backfire, because while you increase the revenues from tariffs, you also have worsened the financing terms because all the foreign investors have fled.
Well, can we end on a positive note? What kind of positive things would you say short term over the next couple of months?
The next couple of months would probably feel like the worst of it, because I think traders still have a pretty unrealistic assumption of policy support. I think that if the S&P 500 already have fallen 8 or 9% in the past 3 days, even as they're assuming that the Fed will cut this year by 110 bips, it means that by the time they realize that the Fed will probably only cut 25 bips or zero or even hiking, that the S&P 500 has a long way to go in correcting.
Wow. So that's not exactly the positive note I was looking for. But I'm so appreciative you came on the show. You and Tyler Cowen, my favorite economists in the world. So thank you again.
You're welcome.
Onward.
You've been listening to Onward, the Fundrise podcast with Anna Wong, chief U.S. economist at Bloomberg Economics. My name is Ben Miller, CEO of Fundrise. We invite you again to please send your comments and questions onward at fundrise.com. And if you like what you've heard, rate and review us on Apple Podcasts. Be sure to follow us wherever you listen to podcasts. For more information on Fundrise's sponsored investment products, including relevant legal disclaimers, check out our show notes. Thanks so much for joining me.